Look, if somebody is demented, suffering from serious dementia now, think of where they're going to be in 5 years. And I say 5 years because Biden would take office if he's reelected in January of
25.
Which means that he wouldn't leave office until January of 29.
Wow.
He would be, what, 86 years old. I mean, we're looking at the free world being run by a vegetable.
Hey, gang, it's me, Dr. Steve. And as Trump surges with ease through the Republican primary and Biden continues to collapse more and more every single day, deep state bureaucrats are obviously beginning to panic. As the seeming inevitability of Trump's second term sets in, we're reminded of his plan to invoke Schedule F and begin slashing unelected federal employees by the tens of thousands, replacing them with hardcore patriots. So in light of what they did back in 2020, the obvious question in all of this is, what are they going to do to try to stop the return of Trump in 2024? Joining me to discuss this is the one and only Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh, of course, is a best-selling author and award-winning filmmaker whose documentaries rank as the highest grossing political films of all time. Dinesh, as always, welcome. Great to have you back. It's always an honor.
Thank you. Good to join you. And boy, we're shaping up for quite a year, it looks like, doesn't it?
That's what I wanted to ask or just start off with you there. I mean, what's, from your vantage point, what's the state of the 2024 race as we stand? Of course, we've had the recent massive bombshell from the special counsel, her report regarding Biden's physical and mental frailty. He got barely half the vote in South Carolina primary that he got in 2020. And then we're seeing Trump setting voter turnout records in every single primary and caucus. So what do you see as the state of things in this race?
Well, my first thought is that the country, I think we all know, is currently being run by a kind of a junta, right? I mean, this is a crazy thing to say in a constitutional democracy, but if Biden isn't steering the canoe, who is?
Right.
Well, okay. Someone is, or some group of people are, and yet we don't know their names. And so we're in a peculiar situation where you've got enormous power, the power of the presidency, and yet it's power without accountability. Why? Because the people doing it are not being held accountable. No one's even calling them out. Biden is the front man. And this seems to have been kind of an open secret. The White House knows this. Jill Biden knows it. And the media knows it. And there's been seemingly a gentleman's agreement, if you want to call it that, like not to bring this up or to pretend like it's not a real issue. And this is where I think Robert Hur comes in, because you got this guy and he's clearly somebody who was trying to help Biden get off the hook.
Right.
But nevertheless, he was, I think, a little shocked to realize that he's dealing with a bit of an imbecile. And and he couldn't help but like blurt that out. And not only did he blurt that out, but I think very significantly, he made that the rationale for not charging Biden. And this sets up a kind of, I don't think he intended to, but a sort of a trap. Because if Democrats go, no, Biden has got his wits, he's incredibly sharp and so on, then it's like, okay, well, then he deserves to be indicted.
And he should be on trial, exactly.
Right, exactly. And in fact, even that is not off the table, because in theory, Merrick Garland can overrule Robert Hur and decide, no, your rationale for not pursuing the case is not mine. I'm going to have the DOJ go ahead and indict him. Now, we all know that is not going to happen. So, but nevertheless, it creates this sort of horns of a dilemma, and that dilemma is becoming increasingly apparent to the American public.
I love how you talk about the lack of accountability there for Biden. They're so quick to refer us as the authoritarians, but it's very interesting. Scholars point out that one of the key characteristics of an authoritarian regime is the lack of accountability for public leaders. If a leader gets to do whatever he wants without any accountability, without any checks and balances, that is by the definition authoritarianism. So it's a very odd sort of projection there going on.
Well, I mean, there was a line I used in the movie Police State where I said, you know, if Trump is the authoritarian, then the police state, the police agencies of the government should be working at the behest of Trump.
Right.
They should be going after Trump's opponents.
Right.
But in fact, Trump is not running the police state. He's running away from the police state. They're after him. And that means that somebody else has dispatched them to go after the political opposition, namely Trump.
Right. Oh, yeah. It's brilliantly put. The NBC poll dropped last week, which found that 76% of voters considered Biden's age and cognition a serious concern for his reelection. Then after the HER report dropped, a new ABC Ipsos poll just came out. I don't know if you saw it, Dinesh, where that number jumped 10 points to 86%. Do you see his age and his senility as his Achilles heel? In other words, the degeneration, everything else can be changed. We've got a degenerating economy, a degenerating border, degenerating law and order. That can all be changed in 4 years. But you can't change his age and you can't change his senility. Do you? And it seems like voters are increasingly connecting the degeneration of those key issues with his physical and mental degeneration. Do you see that with Republicans hammering on it as they are? I think rightly, you see it as his Achilles heel. This is just not something they're going to be able to defend against.
I think it is his annihilation. And I mean, politically, look, if somebody is demented, suffering from serious dementia now, think of where they're going to be in 5 years. And I say 5 years because Biden would take office if he's reelected in January of
25.
Which means that he wouldn't leave office until January of 29.
Wow.
He would be, what, 86 years old. Right. I mean, we're looking at the free world being run by a vegetable.
Yeah.
And I think people do kind of know that. I mean, people see that with their, you know, I'm at the very end of the baby boom generation. You know, we see this with our parents. And so, you know, I find it amusing when I just saw Molly Jong Fast, you know, on a clip on social media. She was MSNBC. She goes, "Well, I don't think we can make these conclusions about Biden. We're not neurologists." And I'm like, we don't really need to be a neurologist.
What is a woman? What is a woman?
You see that you've got a guy here that really doesn't exactly know where he is, probably doesn't know his middle name. You know, if you don't remember, quote, within several years. When your son died. I mean, this is something Biden brings up all the time. So this is not something from the deep recesses of his memory. Supposedly something important to him. So I think we get the picture. Now, here's the point, though. The junta running the country likes to have Biden. I think this is really why there's a problem in the Democratic Party. The reason they like to have Biden is that this way they get to do whatever they want, right? And if you brought in Gavin Newsom, he's going to be like, "Okay, dudes, you know, thanks for all the advice, or you can continue to advise me, but I'm going to be making the decisions from now on." That ends this cozy arrangement in which, whether it's Obama or the Obamaites, whoever's been making these decisions with Biden, just, you know, like a ventriloquist doll, that cozy arrangement comes to an end when Biden goes.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. So let's talk about 2024 a bit. November in particular, I'm thinking of sort of overlapping 2000 mules with police state. And by the way, I'm thinking 2000 Mules really in particular. It's an excellent movie, gang. If you have not seen it, there's a link in the description for you to check it out by streaming. But the question on everyone's mind, and I get this every week in some Q&A live streams and so forth, how do we make sure that what happened in 2020 doesn't happen again? It only seems like the corruption has gotten worse. The police state tactics have gotten worse. And given Biden's cognitive, I love how you did a nice alliteration there, not Achilles heel, but annihilation. Given that, they're only going to be more inclined to engage in fraud since no one's going to vote for him, as it were. So how do we prepare for the election differently in 2024 than in 2020?
Well, it seems like we need things that we haven't put fully into place. There's been some progress since 2020. There have been some election integrity laws. Those will help. There is, of course, the public awareness generated by 2000 Mules. So, for example, it's a little harder to send mules in the middle of the night to drop boxes. People are going to be looking for that. And right. And in 2022, there were patriots in Arizona camped out by the drop boxes, like with their cell phones at the ready, you know, to take footage if anybody showed up. Now, the Democrats are pretty creative, and they usually rely on two types of tactics. The first one is unleveling the playing field. And of course, they were able to do that in many different ways because of COVID. That was the introduction of all these mail-in drop boxes in urban areas anyway. It was the infusion of the $500 million from Mark Zuckerberg. These are ways that you tip the playing field in your favor. It's not illegal, but it is essentially a form of election rigging because it's not a fair fight, you know. The censorship of the Hunter Biden laptop falls into that category. Again, it's not illegal. The media is not free not to report on it. But even if they weren't acting in a conspiracy, they were acting like they were in a conspiracy.
Right.
Now, so that's one set of things. And I think the Democrats are going to be looking for ways to do that in 2024. And maybe by calling up some kind of a bogus crisis as a justification for doing that. This is also part of the reason I think why they are pursuing all this lawfare against Trump. So think of it. Think of that as an original form of election interference, because that's really what it is. People say, oh, they want to send Trump to jail. No, that's not their real goal. That's a means. Their real goal is to prevent Trump from effectively campaigning and getting elected this year. That's their real goal.
Right.
And all these suits are a kind of a way to accomplish that. Now, the problem is that the more Trump surges in the polls, the more that they're going to realize that customary forms of cheating, like rustling up some votes in a homeless encampment, nursing homes, like that's not going to be enough.
Right. It exceeds the margin of fraud.
You're going to need massive fraud. And that's not easy to pull off because, first of all, you know, you're doing this, have to do it in multiple states. You need cooperation of large numbers of people to execute this. So it's not that hard for Republicans to bust it. For example, one way to bust the 2,000 mules operation is simply to insist that something that's already in the election rules, namely 24-hour surveillance of all drop boxes, be put into effect for every drop box. And, you know, we have surveillance, as you know, in every mall, every parking lot. So you're not asking for anything exotic or bizarre. And yet it would put every mule drop on tape, which is what we did not have in 2020. In fact, one of the big objections to the film is demanding footage that didn't exist. Like, show me the same mule at 10 different drop boxes. Well, if 10 out of 10 drop boxes had surveillance footage, I could do that.
Right.
But if 1 out of 10 drop boxes had surveillance footage, your demand becomes unreasonable.
Right.
So there's a lot that can be done and even can be done at this late stage. One of my concerns is with the RNC and the infighting and the kind of clumsy ineffectiveness of Rona McDaniel, and then combine that with the fact that the Trump campaign is so hunkered down on lawsuit expenses and a huge expenditure of time. Who's going to be doing this?
Right.
We can advocate it, but someone needs to do it.
Right. Right. Exactly. The infrastructure is just, it's so tied up in all these other distractions. I'm curious, I mean, have you put any thought on a Ronna McDaniel replacement? Have you made public an opinion on that? I mean, I remember a lot we're talking about Vivek Ramaswamy would be amazing, or someone akin to that, Scott Pressler, who's just that get out the vote, you know, monster. He's amazing. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll offer a general thought because I'm actually not an expert. I mean, Harmeet Dhillon is my Dartmouth classmate, so I would advocate for Harmeet. She knows election laws. She's a fighter. In general, when you look at organizations, and I would say this is true of the country as well. In fact, I think this will give us some insight into why DeSantis didn't make more headway with Trump than he expected, or than I expected, than most of us expected.
It's shocking, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the reason he didn't do better is because there is a critical difference between leadership and administration.
Mm-hmm.
So leadership is keeping the large picture in sight, like Reagan did.
Yeah.
Now, Reagan was not an operational guy. If you told Reagan, you know, go fix the Department of Housing and Urban Development, he'd be like, I don't know how to do that, you know. Like at one point, you know, famously, he didn't recognize his own HUD secretary. He thought he was like a city mayor.
That's
so
right.
it was a very amusing moment from the Reagan. But Reagan's instinct was right. Reagan's instinct was, listen, don't send me down the rat hole of public policy, because it's like I'll never come out if I go in. So you need a leader. I think this is true of the RNC. This is where I'm going with it. And then you need a sort of a guy to burrow into all the details.
Yeah.
Both. The way I look at a guy like DeSantis is he's a really good operations guy. He gets into the details. He works it out. He knows what's in the Disney contract
right.
with the state of Florida. So you need that. At the same time, you need someone who keeps the larger vision in sight. So Trump was able to beat DeSantis hands down on the issue of leadership, even though DeSantis is really good in the execution and probably would be a huge asset if Trump could find a way to deploy him in his administration, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's the, I think it's called the Entrepreneurial Operating System, EOS. And their fundamental tenet is you've got to keep the visionary person and the management position separate. They can't be the same person, literally like left brain, right brain sort of concept. And so, yeah, it sounds to me you're saying DeSantis is very much like a COO, right? A chief operations officer. No, he's not the poet that can inspire and put epigraphy all over glorious monuments and the like.
So a guy like Scott Pressler, whom I like a lot, Scott is just indefatigable. He's dedicated. His motives are pure. I mean, this guy has, at his own expense, gone places and done things that the RNC, with a budget of 1,000 times what Scott can muster, has not done. Scott is an operations guy. And so I don't believe Scott is quite the right guy to head up the RNC. But if I were head of the RNC, one of the first guys I'd call is Scott. Ah,
there you go. Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. Well, but just before we leave that, Vivek is kind of this interesting figure, isn't he? Because he's got both. It seems he's a very visionary fellow. And yet the command of factual data that he has at the fly. You could see how it frustrates the legacy media. That's an interesting mind. I haven't seen that.
I agree completely. Vivek is sui generis. I mean, he is in a league of his own.
Yeah.
And he represents a new generation of conservative leadership think about it. Here's Vivek. What is he? 38, 39 years old. He jumps into a race with the former ambassador to the UN, former South Carolina governor, that's Nikki Haley, the most successful governor in the country by a mile, DeSantis. And he just jumps in there and he's stealing the limelight from these guys, and he is absolutely thrashing them in debates. And then he goes up against the left, which, by the way, Republicans are rarely seen to do.
It's true.
And he not only holds his own, but he makes them look bad.
Yeah.
And so this is a guy who I think who there's a lot of future potential for Vivek. And I think Trump has him on the VP shortlist. I don't know if it'll be Vivek in the end, but I would salivate at the prospect of a Vivek Kamala Harris debate.
Would you call it a debate?
I don't even think she would do it.
I don't know if she'd show up sober at this point. She'd just be laughing and chuckling the whole time. And I don't. Oh my, that would be a sight for sure. One of the keys to Trump's plan to drain the swamp in 2024 is something called Project 2025, which is the initiative led by the Heritage Foundation. We saw Kevin Roberts at Davos giving an amazing speech there. It was absolutely brilliant. But it's all about taking out tens of thousands of embedded deep state operatives, as it were, permanent bureaucrats, get rid of them, and then replace them. They don't want a power vacuum. They want to replace them with tens of thousands of, hardcore, patriotic, America first constituents. What do you think of that strategy? Do you like that? Do you support that? I know a lot of libertarians are nervous with that because they say, oh, you're just replacing one deep state with another deep state. But it seems to me that power vacuums are always going to be filled in politics.
Yeah, I would thinking back to the many years ago when I was a young policy analyst in the Reagan White House, we were trying to slash certain programs. And we realized that because we didn't control Congress, both houses, that you couldn't do it always. Sometimes you would have modest success, but other times the Congress would fund it anyway. Mm-hmm. And now you have a problem, which is to say, what do? Congress has allocated the money. And our simple solution, and I only offer it kind of as a pragmatic way of dealing with this situation, is when you can't cut the personnel or cut the funding, what you do is you transfer it from their guys to our guys.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
their enthusiasm for funding it will also stop once they realize who the money is going to. So take a classic example. The federal government is giving tens of millions of dollars to Planned Parenthood, right? We try to stop it. We would like to discontinue the program, but let's say you can't. Congress says, no, we're allocating the money for family planning services. Okay, you take all that money and you start giving it to adoption agencies.
Right.
So now the left will freak out. They're like, oh my gosh, they're producing a viable alternative to abortion. Suddenly people won't even see the need for it. So then they are no longer excited about allocating that funding. So this is just called operating within the existing lanes of politics. You do, and this, I heard Javier Milei talk about this in Argentina. He goes, listen, some of these libertarians are really mad at me because they want me to slash the entire welfare state. And he goes, listen, I'm doing everything I can, but where I can't do it, I'm gonna sort of minimize the problem, or I'm going to put our guys instead of their guys in, and that's the best I can do. So politics is the art of doing what you can with what is possible.
I love it. Yeah, what you're seeing with him and Nayib Bukele in El Salvador, it's pretty impressive how successful. Particularly Bukele have been. How else could Trump drain the swamp for good this time? Obviously, he had a very hard time the last time he was in office. I mean, now he's ready to go full animal, it seems. I mean, it's personal now, but do you see any other things he can do?
When you get an outsider, there are lots of people who preach the virtues of an outsider, and there are some of those virtues. You don't accept the given lanes, the parameters, the media can't tell you this is what you can say and what you can't say. You bring in a fresh outlook. All of that is good. There is a big downside, and that is it's like walking into a new company where you don't know where the bodies are buried. It's like when Elon Musk came into X. Yeah. He didn't know some of the algorithms. I think some of the algorithms of censorship that were put in are still there.
Yeah.
There are still people who go, I'm still being banned on X. And so evidently Elon's engineers have not dismantled the entire hidden infrastructure of censorship. Now, I don't think that's for lack of intentions. It's just that you need to know where all the codes are so you can go and undo all this stuff. And the same is true with the government. And in fact, it's so intractable. A lot of these problems are, close to a century old. The left has been building this kind of career infrastructure. So I think you need a scorched earth strategy, which is that you have political measures, you have legal measures, and then one measure that people never think of is just good old-fashioned demoralization. Because ultimately, everyone, that goes to work likes to have a sense of self-worth. Like, I went to the work, I had a good day. So this is how the left, I went to work, I'm helping people because I work for the Department of Energy. Now, the reality is that the Department of Energy produces no energy. The Department of Education educates nobody. The department, so these departments all exist as if they are the providers of something, but they don't provide the thing that they're supposed to provide at all. So
neither does Homeland Security. There's no security there either.
I mean, that is so true. So what you have to do is you need to, all these therapists and stuff that have been brought in for diversity, I would remove them. Again, if you can't cut their funding, replace them with therapists that sit down these bureaucrats every day and just demoralize them. You're worthless. You produce nothing. Your office produces nothing. People are disgusted with the kind of person that you are. You might consider a different line of work. Believe it or not, this strategy works.
Yeah, I can imagine.
All you have to do is a systematic policy of making bureaucrats recognize the worthlessness of their own professions.
Right.
And then over time, they'll take early retirement. They'll they'll get out of there because they'll realize that it's become a chilling atmosphere when previously they sort of ran around as if they owned the place.
Maybe we could appoint Jordan Peterson at the head of that project.
I think motivation.
He would revel in it. He would absolutely revel in that. I need you to come to terms with your own worthlessness.
Exactly. It's the, you know, we've been hearing all about these self-esteem projects, and we know that they are useless because, you know, you can't improve someone's academic performance simply by telling them what a great guy they are.
Right.
But maybe this the reverse would work, which is a lowering of bureaucratic self-esteem, a very necessary task.
That's right. That's right. I love it. Well, I want to talk about a project that you've been involved in. It's an amazing project. I've had you on before and others talking about it. Red Referral Network. While all of this stuff is going on, what I love about you, Dinesh, is you don't just sit around and complain and go, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you analyze and then you take action. And you've been very hard at work on a parallel project, a parallel economy project called the Red Referral Network. It's similar, I think, in many ways to Project 2025 in that it's replacing woke corporate culture with a conservative pro-freedom corporate culture by providing a platform for conservative business owners to network and do business together. Can you tell us more about Red Referral Network?
Sure. The idea was proposed to me by my friend Chris Widener. And it was the idea of creating networks around the country, all sort of threaded together. And it's about referring business among conservatives. Mm-hmm. Now, when I first came to America a generation ago, I came as a Rotary exchange student. And I was sponsored by the Rotary Club of a small town in Arizona. And I was very intrigued by Rotary because I thought to myself, wow, all these people come together, they meet monthly, but why? Like, what is their unifying purpose? Now, if you talk to the Rotarians, they would say, oh, well, you know, we do a lot of civic stuff. We adopt a highway. We do the exchange program. And I was always like, but is this the real purpose? And then I realized, no, the real purpose is for a businessman and a carpenter and a plumber and a realtor and a bank lender all to belong to an organization where they can refer business to one another. You need a realtor? Well, Bob over right here will sell your house. You know, you need to have some construction done in your backyard, your kitchen replaced. Well, here's a guy who does exactly that. And so it becomes a profitable way for people to connect with each other. Then I also realized historically that this is basically how ethnic groups have gotten ahead. The most successful ethnic groups all do this. They keep money inside their own community. The Mormons do it. The Hindus do it. The Jews do it. So I realized that what Chris Widener was proposing is an application of this idea to conservatives. Why don't we have a red or conservative networks around the country? Now, the reason this is also very appealing, I think, is because it's an easier way to go than, say, building your own Amazon or building your own university. I mean, that's really hard to do, right? If you can't take back 300 universities, it's even harder to create 300 new ones.
Right, right.
But you've got small businessmen and you've got creative entrepreneurs, and not just entrepreneurs, just people who provide services all over the country. They already exist now. All you're asking them to do is come together. This will give them some social and political connections, but also it's a profitable operation because they can now refer business to one another. So you pay this absurdly low monthly fee. And think about it, if you get a single contract, if you sell a single home, you know, it's so worth it. And so to me, it's a very practical idea. It doesn't require, you know, exotic technology. It doesn't require 50 years to do it. It can be done right away. And I'm like, okay, I'd like to help you to build this.
And it's a very profound social creating mechanism. Patrick Deneen, you know, his thesis on why liberalism failed is it got rid of mediating institutions, the institutions between the government and the person, like the church and community, and you're talking about Rotary clubs and this Red Referral Network. It's literally a mediating institution for a patriot-based parallel economy, without which we're not really going to have one. We've got to have mediating institutions.
Agree completely. And I also think that, you know, you might think, well, this is something that might go over big in red America, but it wouldn't go do so well in blue America. On the contrary, there are lots of conservatives in San Francisco, but they don't know each other. And right. they feel a little beaten down or besieged by the extreme leftism of the surrounding culture. So they're more likely to want to find a place where, gee, you know, every month I like to hang together with some like-minded guys. We can talk about the same things. What I do is I create some educational and political videos for the group. So they have something to talk about. It's like a launching pad for a discussion. And then, you know, we also get to keep our money. We don't want to be subsidizing the very people who are trying to destroy us. Or as Chris Widener likes to say, we don't want to be the people who are tipping our own executioners. Kind of a great phrase, right? Tipping our own executioners.
Yeah, yeah. So,
if the guy's going to execute me, he's not going to get a tip. Let's be clear about that one.
That's good. That I could see Chris saying that. That's very funny. Yeah, that's and you know too. I mean, you know, you've made several very well received documentaries. I can only imagine the network involved in creating something like that is quite vast, and having this more broad network to be able to draw from makes that task infinitely easier.
All these things, I think, involve some work on the supply side, by which I mean, you know, we have to devise ways of attacking these problems. And usually when you do that, you find that it's easier for the other side because they've already done it. So case in point, if Michael Moore wants to make a film, this is how it goes. He goes to a studio. He goes, I want to make a film. And the topic doesn't matter because he's Michael Moore. They go, here's $10 million. Mm-hmm. He makes the film. And then he goes to them and he goes, I'm done. And they go, great. On Monday, you're on The View. On Tuesday, you're on NBC. Then you're this weekend, you're on Face the Nation. It's all done for him. All he has to do is just make the film. Now, that's not true of me. If I do a film, I need to do legal work to create the infrastructure. I need to go raise money from investors. Then I need to make the film. And then I need to market it. And I need to do all of that in the teeth of Facebook censorship and YouTube censorship. And the distributors telling me that they won't help me. And so that's the way it is for our side until you build something. And once you've built it, then you realize, okay, well, I now have ways of navigating around these obstacles. And so the pathway is a little more clear, but it's always harder at the beginning. You're rolling the stone up the hill.
Yeah. But that is, in many respects, that really is the immigrant story, as it were, isn't it? Building community within the nation, and then over a generation or two, the next thing you know, it's the way of initiating other members into the nation through this amazing community where they can rise and achieve. It's absolutely wonderful. My wife's in Japan, and that's one of the things that she's always, you know, she always gets involved with Japanese Bible studies and, you know, Japanese haircutting parties and all this sort of stuff. But those infrastructures, they both affirm identity, but also help integrate and draw them into the blessings of the country. It's a win-win, and it's just so beautiful. And you've obviously been very successful in the networks you've built, and I can only imagine that same success is going to transfer over to Red Referral Network. Already is, as I see. How can people get connected with Red Referral Network?
So the website is redreferralnetwork.com. Very simple, redreferralnetwork.com. And while it was kind of being built out over the last several weeks, it's now kind of up and running. In fact, I just had Chris Widener on my podcast talking about like steps you can take to kind of get involved. So just go to redreferralnetwork.com and check it out. And the immigrant model that you mentioned is very interesting because very often on the right we're identified with, you know, we're the natives and then they're the immigrants.
Right.
But when I first came to America, I was really struck by the fact that there were so many Asian Indians in the motel business. I thought to myself, that's odd. I mean, it's not because Asian Indians are like big into motels at home or something. Yeah. I think what it is they realize it's a business in which even if you don't speak the language, you have a family. Let's say there's only one guy that can speak fluent English. Well, they put that guy behind the counter. Everybody is working in the maid's room or the back. and you're able to put your family to work, which keeps your overhead low. And so you can make a profitable business, whereas it may not work for Hilton or it may not work for one of the big chains. And so that's why it makes sense. And so we need today, we're in the position as conservatives where we need that kind of nimbleness and resourcefulness, obviously not in the same way. We speak the language, but rather in our creativity in overcoming obstacles in a culture that is, by and large, at least in its mainstream thrust, hostile to us.
It is. And it is, I think it's an apropos metaphor in that so many conservatives feel like they lost their country. They're in a foreign land. They don't understand how to live in this world anymore that doesn't know what a woman is or anything like that. So it's all the more, I think, necessary to start building these kind of these parallel infrastructures, as it were. And I thank you so much for it. Again, I love how you analyze and take action. It's the combination of the two. Gang, this is an amazing opportunity to really build a parallel economy through a unique platform for business networking among those who share the values of faith, family, and freedom. Make sure to click on the link below or visit redreferralnetwork.com and get connected with the insiders who are actively building the Patriot Parallel Economy as we speak. It's wonderful stuff. Dinesh, it's an honor as always. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.